And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning here in Southeast Kansas. Stop for Greenside Up, and joining us in studio this morning is Jesse Gilmore. It's been a while since I've seen you, Jesse. How are you doing, man?
Pretty good. Staying upright in the wind out there right now.
I stepped outside to grab my charging cable for my phone, and it's just like it's brittle out there, to say the very least. And it's supposed to be like that pretty much all day. So be sure you have the big coats on before you head on out. Don't be like me and not have one. All right. Well, Jesse, of course, we'll have Wendy Powell here on in a little bit. She will be calling in for her portion of the show. But talking about food safety today, and did you say you have a course coming up about food safety?
Yeah. So Kansas and K-State, the Kansas Department of Agriculture, are putting on a joint FSMA training session. FSMA stands for Food Safety Modernization Act, and it basically serves as the regulatory guidance for large-scale producers, which I believe, and don't quote me on this, is over $5,000 in produce sales per year. I'm not 100% sure on that. So if you sell less than $5,000 worth of produce, you don't have to go through FSMA training. But since food safety is always in the best interest of the seller and the consumer, you get a lot of benefits from going through the training anyway, and it is free to Kansas and Missouri growers. I'm sure Oklahoma and Arkansas growers have something similar, but it would cost, I think, $20, maybe $30. I can't remember for the online session. The online session will be January 25th and 27th from 1 to 5, so 2 4-hour sessions online via Zoom. You can register for that on the food safety webpage at ksre.ksu.edu. And if you do have any other questions about that, you can get in touch with your local extension agent. Obviously, for Wildcat District, that would be me.
And like you said, I think it's like you said, under $5,000, you don't have to, but it's still encouraged to do it, though, because food safety is important for everybody.
Yep. Yeah. Obviously, you don't want to get your customers sick, because they won't be your customers for long at that
exactly.
point.
All right. Well, Jesse, talking about, you were talking about, got that food safety course going on, but overall you wanted to talk about food safety today, correct?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things to keep in mind when either purchasing or growing produce for sale. When it comes to contamination, as we think of it, really there's two different types of contamination that you can run into. There's chemical contamination and there's biological contamination. And biological contamination gets a lot of the press because whenever there's outbreaks of E. coli or food poisoning, usually they're pretty widespread and on pretty popular produce items like spinach. Chemical contamination is also... doesn't get as much emphasis as I think it probably should. When it comes to chemicals, obviously, you're thinking of insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, and grouped together in the broad term of pesticides. And there's two ways, really, well, three ways, but I'll cover that in a little bit. There's three ways that a set of produce can be contaminated chemically. The first is that you overapply a certain chemical during the growing season, which should be pretty easy to control if you're a produce grower, because the label for any pesticide that you have will tell you how many times and at what rates you can apply a given chemical during a growing season, depending on the crop that you're trying to grow. So different crops will have different tolerance levels for the amount of chemical that can be applied. The second and more sneaky way for chemicals to contaminate potential produce is through applying chemicals too soon to when you harvest. So every chemical is going to have something called a pre-harvest interval, which is basically the amount of time you have to give between when you harvest the plant and when you last apply a certain chemical. And these are going to be different for every chemical because each chemical is going to break down at different rates. And the idea of the pre-harvest interval is that you give residues enough time to break down and become inert before consuming it. And if you don't honor the pre-harvest interval for a particular chemical, You are more likely to consume higher amounts of residue, which can have negative health effects, especially with insecticides. If you're a grower and you want to reduce the pesticide load that you might potentially be giving to your consumers, and you just cut out one thing, cut out insecticides. They are easily the most toxic of the pesticides that you can apply. You can easily find alternative ways to control insects, either through improved variety selection that shows better pest resistance, crop selection for plants that don't necessarily have a ton of pests, root crops in particular are especially good at that, and organic options. If you're a consumer and you're buying at a farmer's market, always buy local when you can, because you have the opportunity to form that relationship with the grower and ask questions about their growing process that you would definitely not be able to ask if you were just buying produce at a grocery store. Obviously, you know, a lot of people won't have the option to buy from farmers markets, but if it's there, it's a really good option.
And the good thing is, usually in this area, especially when in the warmer months, usually you got a farmer's market going on here in Coffeeville, one in Independence. I think there's also one that goes on in Caney. So at least in Montgomery County, you know, you got several choices to choose from at that point. So when you get that chance, head out to those, correct?
Yeah, definitely. And we should have, I believe there is a list of farmer's markets available on the Produce Safety website of farmers markets in our area where you can go and buy from these local producers. One final way that customers can kind of control what chemical contamination they might be exposed to, and it isn't a huge deal, but organic, if you're buying certified organic produce, that will help a lot, because in order to be certified organic, you have to have a very set, controlled list of pesticides that you can apply. And these were chosen specifically for their lower toxicity to people. So if you are buying from a certified organic producer, you are much less likely to encounter those highly toxic chemicals that you might see in more conventional systems.
Is there a different time between harvest and applying that for those people that do organic? Is there a different timeline because they're using like less things that are less toxic?
Well, it does depend on the chemical. I have seen chemicals that can be applied the same day you harvest. So it's got a 0-day pre-harvest interval. And that actually is not specific to organic production. Sometimes that is also used in conventional production. And just because something is labeled as conventional production does not mean that they are trying their best to minimize their or does not mean that they are not trying their best to minimize their chemical load. It just means that there is one or more aspects of the production that disqualifies them from organic standards. You will commonly see producers label their methods as organic methods without saying they are organically certified. So that means that they are using alternative methods of pest control that would be lower impact on their consumers and on the environment. But one or more things, usually it will be fertilizer that keeps them from being organic, because the list of organic fertilizers is very small and very hard to much harder to stay in line with in more rural areas, mm-hmm. where fertilizers are more homogeneous, I guess is the right word. Urea, diammonium phosphate, some of those will be organic.
Mm-hmm.
But it very much narrows, unless you're getting soil that already has the optimum level of nutrients for everything you're trying to grow, which I don't think I've seen in any of the soil samples that I've done, you are going to have to fertilize, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to disqualify you from organic standards down here.
All right. So some good information there for you about food safety today. And Again, we'll have Wendy Powell here in just a little bit. Do you have anything else for us this morning?
Yeah, I did want to touch on biological contamination a little bit, just because that gets a lot of the press.
Mm-hmm.
Biological contamination is just microbes that cause human disease ending up on your produce in some way. Usually it's going to be through water. And this will kind of go back to a little bit of chemical contamination. In a lot of cases, you're going to see that either through the choice of water you use to irrigate your crops with or flooding. And flooding is very, very bad for produce. The FDA actually recommends that if you have flood exposed produce, to just discard it. You can't really use it because there's such a high risk of biological and chemical contamination.
Yeah, because that water is so contaminated at that point that it's not safe for consumption.
Yeah, you get a lot of runoff from highly fertilized areas that then comes down to your produce and your fertilizers and pesticides. You have no idea where that water is coming from and what was applied where it ran off. So that is the third way that I mentioned for chemical contamination. But biological contamination is almost always going to be water-based. So flood water, obviously you want to discard it. Mm. Just play it safe. You might be able to wash off most of the contaminants, but you can't guarantee that all the contaminants are going to be gone. The other way is your irrigation source. If you're irrigating your crops with tap water or city water, municipal water, usually that's going to be treated enough to where there's no bacteria in it at all. If you're irrigating from a surface water source like a pond or lake, or if you're irrigating from a well, that is a little bit more iffy. We do water tests, water quality tests, to determine the level of bacteria in sources like that. I've seen wells with no bacteria in them at all. I've seen wells with more bacteria in it than the lab can quantify.
Oh my goodness.
It's very...
That's a lot.
Very hit or miss, and it very much emphasizes the importance of getting your irrigation water tested if you are giving or selling your produce to other people, because your irrigation methods can change in order to minimize potential for contamination. Also, you have the option of selecting more contamination-resistant plants. Root crops in particular are really good at this because they get washed. Most of the bacteria that might end up on the part that gets eaten will be soil, will be broken down in the soil by other microbes, so it'll become inactivated too. So root crops in particular are very good at not being contaminated. Usually most of the contaminated crops you will see are leafy plants. If you are irrigating from a spot that has high contamination rates, soil-based irrigation methods, like drip tape or some kind of soaker hose at the base of the plant, is a great way to use potentially contaminated water, because you're not getting the water on the part of the plant that gets eaten. As long as you're not splashing that water or keeping that water on the part that gets eaten, your chances of contamination are much lower, and obviously getting tested. So, one thing I did want to point out for any of our listeners in Kansas or Missouri who grow produce commercially, water testing labs at the University of Missouri and Kansas State University have free testing available for their water through August of 2023, I believe. And if you're in Missouri, you can get in touch with your local extension agent to figure out how to get the samples to the lab for testing. For Kansas, you would either send them or bring them into the campus at K-State Olathe or in Manhattan. If you would rather ship them, obviously you can get in touch with me to coordinate that. We've sent, I think, maybe 10 or 15 samples to the lab ever since I started advertising that this testing is available. And like I said, hit or miss in terms of bacterial quantity. And from there, your extension agent, or me, if it's me in the Southeast Kansas area, will make recommendations on irrigation and crop options based on your bacteria levels, just so that we can keep contamination to a minimum.
Absolutely. So, Jesse, if somebody did want to call you for like testing or anything else that we've talked about today, how can they get a hold of you?
They can call the Girard office, 620-724-8233, or they can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Well, thank you, Jesse, for coming in today. We really do appreciate it, and we will talk to you again here soon. We're going to talk to Wendy Powell on the other side of the break. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And good morning. Welcome back to Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. It's time for the second part of Greenside Up this morning. Wendy Powell will be joining us here in just one moment. But Jesse, before that, let's go over those events that you have coming up here pretty soon.
Sure. So in the first half, I mentioned FISMA training online, January 25th and 27th. From 1 to 4 p.m. on both days, so 8-hour session. That is done through Zoom, and that registration is available. It is free for Kansas and Missouri producers. Oklahoma and Arkansas, I'm sure, have something similar. One thing I forgot to mention in the first half is that there will also be in-person trainings on February 9th at in Olathe from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And on, I'm pretty sure it's February 9th in Olathe and February 18th in Wichita. So if you did want to attend one in-person session for FISMA certification, you have either of those two options as well. And I'm fairly confident both of those are also free.
All right. So good training coming up for FISMA. And like you said, it's online, but there's also a couple of in-person ones if you'd like to attend those as well. All right. Well, Jesse, thank you so much. And we'll go ahead and throw it over to Wendy Powell. She's with us this morning. And Wendy, good morning. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm great. How are you, Kyle?
I'm doing pretty good. So, Wendy, before we get started with your main subject today, you have some events coming up as well, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I've been working on a couple of meetings. I'm really excited to announce that Animal Health Day will be returning for this year. This is a really a long traditional program for Montgomery County that is going to happen this year on March 2nd at the Independent Civic Center. And so folks can be looking out for the details on that program. And then also we're going to be doing a CalCast marketing program on March 7th in Girard. So anybody looking to get into catching or utilizing some of the programs that are out there for CalCast marketing, that program will be really beneficial.
All right, so some good programs coming up with that. So, Wendy, today you'll be talking about taking care of orphaned calves, and it probably happens a little bit more than some people think, correct?
Yes, unfortunately, things happen. Sometimes, you know, the mother doesn't make it, or she doesn't have enough milk, or just a variety of things can happen. And sometimes a cow will have twins but doesn't necessarily want to claim both of them. That's another scenario that we get stuck with. So taking care of orphan calves is a really huge responsibility, as you might imagine, just taking care of a baby. So a couple of things that are really important to highlight here would be that colostrum, that first milk that is given by a new mother of any species. It's full of antibodies and really dense nutrients that the calf needs to have as soon as possible. And what's really interesting that the calf's stomach can absorb and use these important antibodies so quickly by just transferring that through their system. But as the calf gets older, just within hours, so like 6 hours after birth, the stomach can only absorb 2/3 of those available antibodies. And then after 24 hours, the absorption capacity is reduced to 11%. So pretty much after a day old, that calf cannot really use those antibodies. Their digestive enzymes are breaking down and digesting the antibodies instead. So it's really important to get to those calves quickly, within, you know, 30 minutes or an hour of birth, to make for sure they get that colostrum in there, so that they can get that healthy start to their lives. Because there's lots of research that shows animals that don't get that colostrum, it affects them throughout their lives. So that's probably the most very important part of taking care of a calf that doesn't have a good mama. And then after that, for a calf at least, they can be fed up to twice a day, two or three times a day from a calf bottle with a calf nipple. And this is quite a bit bigger than what you would use for a goat or a sheep. And then you just can, commercial milk replacers are widely available. You reconstitute that with warm water, and it makes an excellent and usually an economical liquid feed for these baby calves. So for the first 3 weeks, they should be fed this commercial milk replacer. Or if you're able to have another animal on the farm that has extra milk, you can always feed that to the calf as well. It doesn't have to be something you purchase. So milk replacers should always contain 18 to 22% crude protein. That's what you're aiming for. 10 to 22% crude fat, and less than that, less than half of a percent of crude fiber. So commercial milk replacers, they're already mixed that way. And so if you're using something off the farm, then that's some goals to reach there. Within 4 days of a calf being fed the milk replacer, you can start with some calf starter and some fresh, clean drinking water. So calf starter is just a feed that's really palatable, and it's got some protein, minerals, and vitamins in it. And you can give that, offer that to the calf for the first couple of weeks. And, of course, they're just going to nibble at it to begin with. So you want to only give a few ounces and then go ahead and take away anything that they don't consume. But then they're like at 3 or 4 weeks of life, they're going to really take off with that intake. So as they start eating more feed, they're going to drink more, of course, and all of that will lead to more weight gain. I encourage folks not to offer hay until the calves are weaned from the bottle, just because the digestive system gets all confused. So a lot of folks, whenever they're bottle feeding a calf, they're like, you know, how long do I really got to do this? And a lot of times folks will just give a time frame, you know, a calf needs to be on a bottle for X number of weeks or whatever. But if you really get down to the science of things, what you're looking for is when the calf is eating about a pound and a half of this calf starter every day for 3 days in a row. And then that is when the calf is able to feed itself enough to not necessarily need that milk. So sometimes that can be when the calf is 4 weeks old. Sometimes, you know, they're closer to 10 weeks old. And that just sounds like torture for a livestock producer to bottle feed a calf for 10 weeks. And so that's something to work towards. Whenever you're weaning a calf from the milk, you can do that either cold turkey, just pull it off, or you can work on it gradually over 3 or 7 days, just giving a smaller amount each time and then cutting out a feeding, of course. And then after weaning, you're going to want to, whenever you're changing the grain mix, if you're pulling them off of the calf starter, you want to do that slowly, of course, so that their digestive system doesn't get upset. And then if you're needing to move the calf, you know, to a different pen or a different lot, you want to make those changes one at a time over a two-week period. So do things kind of slowly. Their immune system is not quite as sturdy as what a calf would have in the pasture nursing a cow, because that cow offers lots of immunity still through their milk. And so it's really important that bottle calves are kept in a clean environment and cared for carefully so that they're not vulnerable for diseases like coccidiosis or the millions of bacteria that can create calf scours. So there's lots of things to consider when bottle feeding a calf. Of course, some of these tips also translate to other species as well. You just kind of got to make for sure that the milk that you're using is meets the nutrient requirements of the animal you're working with. So if anybody has any questions along those lines, I'm happy to work with them, or of course they can work with their vet. This is a good time to have a good vet-client relationship with your local vet. I can be reached at the Altamont office, 620-779-1409. And of course, anybody is welcome to shoot me an email too. My email address is Wendy, W-E-N-D-I-E, P as in Paul, O-W-E-L-L, at ksu.edu. And I just want to let folks know that, again, Animal Health Day is slated for March 2nd in Independence, and we are really excited to bring that program back.
All right, so that is coming up here pretty soon. And Wendy, we appreciate you calling in today, and we hope you are doing well. And we will talk to you again next time.
Okay, thanks, Kyle.